Every few years, I try to reread the book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And the book follows four children, Edmund, Edward, Lucy, and Susan Peverly, as they're living through World War II. And they're forced to flee their home in the city due to the bombing raids. And so instead, they come to live in the huge home of a professor in the countryside. And one day, in this huge new home, they decide to play hide and seek. And so Lucy, the youngest of the four children, goes off to hide. And she comes into a room where she sees a huge wardrobe that she thinks would be a great place to hide. And so she steps into the wardrobe and sees that it's filled full with coats. And so she pushes through the first layer of coats and behind it and continues to push deeper and deeper in order to try and hide herself from her siblings. And as she pushes herself deeper and deeper, it becomes cooler and colder and colder until she finally steps out of the wardrobe completely and into a completely new world. Turns out that this wardrobe wasn't just a wardrobe, but was also a door. It was a door to a new world. It was a door to a place called Narnia. It was a door to a place for the four Peverly children that would lead to transformation. For these four children, it was a door into new life and transformation. We're in a sermon series here at 10th called I Am, where we're listening to the call of God, listening to the voice of Jesus who says, I am. And so far we've heard him say, I am the bread of life. I am the light to the world. And today we'll listen to Jesus say, I am the door. So if you have your Bibles, physical or electronic, you can pull them out now to John 10, verses 7 through 10, or you can follow along on the screen behind me. Therefore, Jesus said again, very truly I tell you, I am the door for the sheep. All who have come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep have not listened to them. I am the door. Whoever enters through me will be saved. They will come in and go out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. The context that Jesus is sharing these words is in the context of having just healed a blind man. And then he engages in a confrontation with the Pharisees, who were the religious leaders of Jesus' own day. And the confrontation centers around the fact that Jesus has healed on a Sabbath. See, in Jesus' first century Palestinian world, it was against the law to heal on the Sabbath. And in the Pharisees' defense, the law was a gift from God. This is why David himself in Psalm 119 says these words, "Let your compassion come to me that I may live, for your law is my delight." And on top of that, the Sabbath is, in fact, a part of the law, but it's also one of the Ten Commandments. So it's meant to be a great gift from God. But what Jesus is saying to the Pharisees is that in focusing so much on something good, namely the law, they've actually missed something better. They've missed this gift that God has given to this blind man through Jesus' healing miracle. And more importantly, they're missing who Jesus is showing them who he is in and through this miracle. They have turned something good and allowed it to distract and divert them from something even better. They've taken something good and allowed them to distract them from something even better. And so Jesus, in front of the Pharisees and in front of the crowd, begins to talk about who he is, to clarify who he is. And then we get the words that we just read. Jesus says in verse 7, "Very truly I tell you, I am the door for the sheep." Now I think before we go any further, it's important to recognize that on the surface, this is probably the most underwhelming of all of Jesus' I am statements, especially compared to the last two that we just heard. First one was, I am the bread of life. Second one, I am the light to the world. I am the door to the sheep. I'm a sheep door. It's kind of underwhelming, hey? Bread of life, light to the world, and now Jesus saying, I am a sheep door. But what Jesus is inviting us into is to see who he is, and something very important about who he is and the invitation that he is inviting us into. And so let's go back to the passage together. Jesus saying, I am the door to the sheep. When he says these words, his audience may likely have initially thought of this picture here, a sheep pen. And what would happen is the shepherd would take his sheep and lead them into the pen at night, and then the shepherd would sleep across the entrance of the pen, in a way acting as the door. And in doing so, to offer a place of safety, security, belonging to the sheep at night. In a way, it's like he's offering a kind of home to them to sleep. And then in the morning, the shepherd gets up and gets out of the door, or gets out of the doorway to the pen, and leads the sheep out into pasture. And just as Jesus says that he is a door, he's making a similarity between the shepherd who says that he is a door. The shepherd leads the sheep in to something and leads them out to something. And so Jesus is saying that he is the door for us, leading us into something and leading us out to something. And the question is, what? What is he leading us into, and what is he leading us out to? And that's at the heart of what we're going to be looking at together today. And so let's look at that first movement, what Jesus is inviting us into. One commentator says that Jesus is inviting us into a relationship with God the Father. A relationship that he describes as a relationship of safety, security, and belonging. In a way, just as the shepherd who sleeps across the door for the sheep at night offers a safe home for them to sleep, so too Jesus is inviting us into a relationship with God the Father, and in a way, he too is offering a kind of home, a place of safety and security and belonging. No matter what we've been through, no matter what we have, no matter what we've lost, he's inviting us to come home. When I was studying at UBC, I had this tradition where at the end of many of my semesters, I would pack up my bag and I would take a bus and take it out to the float plane terminal in Vancouver. And I would take a plane out to Salt Spring Island where my parents live, and my parents are here joining us today. And I remember one year, my first year, getting off the plane and feeling utterly exhausted. And my mom was visiting last weekend as well, and so she affirmed that this story is true. But I got off the float plane and I looked utterly worn and exhausted. My shoulders were probably up to my ears. I had had a difficult semester and I just finished my exams. And so my body just looked worn out. On top of that, what they couldn't see is that my mind was worn and exhausted and filled with fear. It had been a rough semester and I was afraid. Afraid of what my exam results might be and what that might mean for my future and for myself. And so I came off of the float plane utterly exhausted, worn, weary, and my mind filled with fear. And they picked me up at the terminal and they drove me to their home on the island. And shortly after unpacking my bags and laying down on the couch, my body and my mind began to rest and come into a place of peace. And I don't just think it's because of my mom's cooking. I don't think it's just because they live on the side of a lake and there's a beautiful aesthetic, although both of those things were really good and helpful. I think the primary reason that my body and my mind experienced this kind of transformation when I came home is because I came home. Because in my parents' home, at this point I hadn't yet met Sabine. We weren't in a home together. And so this was the place where I knew the most safety, security, and belonging. I knew that no matter what I'd been through, no matter what I had, and maybe no matter what I had lost, I knew that I could come home to a place of safety, security, and belonging, that I would come in and be loved and embraced. And I recognize that not everyone's childhood home was a place of safety and security and belonging. But ideally, Our childhood homes are places where we experience peace and rest, where we know we are safe and secure, and where we experience this sense of belonging. No matter what we've done, no matter who we are, no matter what we have, and no matter what we've lost. That there's something core about who we are in the sense of our need to belong to someone. Last year I read a book by Dr. Sue Johnson called Hold Me Tight. And in the book, Dr. Sue Johnson draws on attachment theory. And she says this great line. She says, "Love is not the icing on the cake of life, but it's a basic primary need like oxygen or water. Love is not the icing on the cake of life, but it's one of our most basic human needs, like oxygen or water." The theologian and writer J.I. Packer said, "To be right with God the judge is a good thing, but to be loved and cared for by God the Father is even better." And Jesus is inviting us into a loving relationship with God the Father, where our most basic need to be loved and attended to belong, is met in Him. No matter what we've been through, no matter the chaos that lives in the world around us, no matter what we have and no matter what we lost, we are invited into this relationship with God the Father to experience His love and a sense of deep belonging with Him. We're invited to come into a relationship with God the Father as His beloved and dear children. Dallas Willard calls this life a life without lack. Could you imagine that? To truly experience the feeling that life is without lack. That you don't need to grasp, to stretch and bend, to prove yourself, to prove your identity. Can you imagine that? To have such a security in the sense of who you are, that you experience life without lack. That's what we're being invited into. To have our home in God the Father, and as we receive His love and grace, as we make our home in Him, that we feel like we have what we truly need. And we experience life as life without lack. Through the Lenten season, I've been trying to enter into this reality through a prayer that I've been praying most days. It's a prayer of St. Ignatius, and it helps me to enter into the reality that no matter what I have or what I've lost, no matter what the day holds or my past holds, I have been given all that I need, God's love and His grace. And let me read this prayer to you. "Take, Lord, and receive my liberty, my memory, my understanding, and my entire will. All I have and call my own, You have given to me. To You, I return it. Everything is Yours. Do with it what You will. Give me only Your love and Your grace, for that is enough for me." That's the invitation of what Jesus is inviting us to come into. He's inviting us to come into a relationship with God the Father where we have what we truly need. We can experience a life without lack because no matter what we have or lost or have experienced, that we still have God's love and grace and the ability to come home to Him. So we're invited to come home into the presence of God. And from there, Jesus is inviting us to go out into something. And in the passage, He says in verse 9, "I am the door. Whoever enters through me will be saved. They will go in and come out and find pasture." Jesus says that they will go out to find pasture. And what exactly is this pasture? Jesus describes just a little bit later. He says in verse 10, "I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." And the word that Jesus is using here for having life to the full doesn't just mean to the top. The word actually means overflow, excessive, abundant life. The word picture is this idea of a pitcher, not just filling a glass right to the top, but of overflow. More and more and more life filling us until it literally overflows from us. That's what Jesus is inviting us into. From that place of loving, safe, secure belonging with God to enter out into this sense of overflowing life with God. Not just a life without lack, but a life of abundance. The difficulty is, if we're honest, that we too, like the Pharisees, have difficulty in that we turn things that are good and allow them to distract us and to take away from something that is even better. Let me give you an example. For some of you, you may think this is pretty trivial, but this is very real for me. When I drive into work in the morning, it's about a 20-minute drive, most often, especially if Sabine's not in the car with me, the one and first thing I do is turn on sports radio, almost every single time. And I've noticed recently that there's a stark difference between when I turn on sports radio, which is about 90% of the time, and the few times when I leave the radio off and do something like entering into silent prayer or turning on worship music or even listening to an app like Praise You Go. That those times when I enter into silent contemplative prayer or worship music or an app like Praise You Go, I show up to work after my 20-minute drive filled with peace and joy and typically a deeper sense of purpose for my day. And again, there's nothing wrong with sports radio. I think it's actually great. But I've been surprised that if you gave me an opportunity to choose listening to prayer and doing silent contemplative prayer on my way to work, which usually results in joy and peace and a greater sense of purpose, or listening to sports radio, 90% of the time I would still choose sports radio. And I began to ask myself, why? Why do we do this to ourselves sometimes? To turn things that we like and things that are good, to allow it to pull us away from something better. And this is a question that I've been asking myself, and I think there's something within us that has the tendency, even though we are compelled by the door that Jesus offers to us, that offers abundant life, I think there's a part of us too that wants to hedge our bets, hey? There's good life over here, but let's keep that door propped open because I really want that. But let's keep this door propped open too, and let's keep that door propped open too, that we want the life that's over here, but we kind of also want the life that's over here, and the life that's over here, and the life that's over here. And again, none of these other doors are bad in and of themselves, but sometimes they take away from our opportunity to truly embrace that overflowing life that's being offered to us. What are some of the doors that you prop open? Things that can be good, but take away from an opportunity to embrace something better. And I think if you're at all like me, there's a sense when we ask this question, maybe to feel a little bit of guilt. And let me free you from that. The invitation to the door and away from the other doors is not an invitation to feel guilty over what we've done, but an invitation to be compelled by something that is beautiful and outstanding. To be compelled to a life of overflow. And to recognize that even when we prop open the other doors, that Jesus isn't just over there inviting us to come to him, but he's actually there with us, even as we seek to prop open the doors. Standing with us, saying, this place is good, but I still want you to experience, I'm inviting you to experience something that's even better, something more beautiful. It's a kind of life that can only be given in and through God. As we experience the very source of life to enter into us, through the Holy Spirit. It's a kind of life that we experience here in this world and grows over the course of our life as we are compelled to enter into the door. And the kind of life that grows even beyond death. I've been rereading the book, a biography by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, The German Pastor and Writer. And Bonhoeffer lived during World War II, but before the war, his life involved many things that, for many of us, feel and look like a life of flourishing. He played music, he enjoyed traveling, he ate good food, and he had great, rich friendships. In fact, he wrote still my favorite book on friendship called Life Together. But then, during the war, he became involved in a plan to assassinate Hitler. Even though he's a confessing pacifist, he got involved in a plan to assassinate Hitler, which failed. And when it was discovered that he was a part of this assassination plot, he was arrested and taken to prison. And what's amazed me most about the life of Bonhoeffer is that even after going to prison and having his life deprived of some of the things that he enjoyed and loved most, music, friendship, good food, and traveling, it didn't inhibit his ability to experience overflowing life. That even in prison, later after the war, many of the prison guards and his cellmates would say that in prison, Bonhoeffer actually looked happy. And he would encourage many of those cellmates who looked depressed during their time there. That for Bonhoeffer, overflowing life didn't just depend on traveling or friends or other things that he truly enjoyed, but it depended on one thing alone, namely the presence of God. That prison couldn't take away that experience of overflowing life, and for Bonhoeffer, so too neither could death. On the day he was killed, Bonhoeffer said this: "This is the end for me. For me, the beginning of life. This is the end. For me, the beginning of life." That Bonhoeffer knew the secret that no matter what he had, no matter what he had experienced, and no matter what he had lost, overflowing life depends only on one thing: the presence of the source of life itself coming to and flowing through us, the presence of God itself. And the invitation for us is to come into a relationship with God the Father, to experience that life of lack, or life without lack, and then to go out into the world to experience a life of flourishing as we are filled with the Spirit, to embrace that life without lack, and therefore also to go out into a life of flourishing as we are filled with the very life and presence of God. And Jesus is able to promise this because of who he says and shows that he is. When Jesus says, "I am the door," he's saying two things. The first he's saying is, "I am the door," what we've just looked at together. But he's also saying, "I am." "I am" is the name that God gave himself to Moses. And Jesus is using his words in the original language in a very particular way to make very clear that he is not only the door, but he's saying, "I am that I am." I can help you to come into a relationship with God the Father, to experience a kind of home, a secure attachment and belonging with him, because I am one with God the Father. I am the door to overflowing life because life itself will come into and flow through you because I am one with God the Holy Spirit. And the life of God itself will come and enter into you to a sense of abundance and overflowing in and through me. When we say we believe in Jesus, when we invite the presence of Jesus to come to us, these aren't just mere words. They're an open door of transformation. An open door to a whole new world. They're an open door both to a place of secure belonging with God the Father and to a sense of overflowing life. And for each of us, the invitation to come to the door isn't a one and done opportunity, but an opportunity to come every day, to be compelled by the beauty of the door and the life that's being offered to us. Not a life of guilt, a life of shame, a life of lack, but a life without lack, and a life into abundance. And for every person seeking that life, it involves at the least coming to the door the first time and inviting that life of God to enter into us, that we too can experience a life without lack and a life of overflow. That no matter who we are and what we have or what we've lost, the circumstances of our lives, that what cannot be taken from us is God's love and his grace. I invite you now to join me in prayer. I'm going to pray the prayer of St. Ignatius that I read earlier. And my hope is that this would be your prayer now. Take, Lord, and receive my liberty, my memory, my understanding, my entire will. All I have and call my own, you have given all to me. To you I return it. Everything is yours. Do with it what you will. Give me only your love and your grace. That is enough for me. Amen.